Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Battleground 44 with me, Patrick Bishop, and Saul David. It's now nearly 3 months since we began the series, and we've had a very gratifying reaction from listeners. So thanks to everyone who's emailed to say they're enjoying listening to it. We're certainly enjoying making it. We've got some great material in the pipeline, including a series within a series, if you like, on the warlords who dominated the conflict, explained and illuminated for you by some great masters of contemporary history. So in the coming weeks, we're bringing you Simon Sebag Montefiore on Stalin, Andrew Roberts on Churchill, Roger Moorhouse on Hitler, and so forth. It's going to be great. But today we're discussing one of the most significant but little-known battles of the war in the Far East. That is the gallant stand of the 50th Indian Parachute Brigade against a numerically superior Japanese force at Sangshak in the Manipur district of Assam, northeast India, which took place from the 22nd to the 26th of March, 1944, 80 years ago this month. The parachutists were eventually forced to withdraw, but their heroic defence gave just enough time for the defenders of nearby Imphal and Kohima to repel a major Japanese offensive and save India. Now, before we start on the event itself, Saul, I want you to talk a little bit about the overall strategic situation. We've got to remember the British had been ejected from Burma by the Japanese 2 years previously. Now the situation has improved a great deal, especially in the field of supply. And some of those directing the war think the time is right to retake Burma. Some, but not all. Churchill and Bill Slim, the commander of the 14th Army, made up of British, Indian, and Empire troops, are opposed to the idea. Japan has lost control of the Pacific thanks to the American victories there and is slowly being strangled to death, but too slowly from the Americans' point of view. They want the Brits to storm back into Burma and reopen the land route across northern Burma so they can keep supplying their ally Chiang Kai-shek and his nationalist Chinese. So, Saul, tell us something about that debate and why the Americans eventually won it.
Well, I mean, the real problem for the British and the Indians, if we use the term Indian Army, Patrick, I think that's shorthand. I think everybody, I hope all the listeners will know that that effectively means a kind of polyglot force that's been drawn from all over the place. The 14th Army, which Slim is in control of by 1944, has got people from West Africa, it's got Indians, it's got British troops, it's got, you know, a real mixed bag. And part of the problem with this polyglot army is that it's got a kind of varied fighting ability. So they have, since they've been thrown out of Burma in 1942, the British Indian British force in 1942, made a number of incursions, attempts to get back in, very few of which have been successful at all. I suppose people probably know best the Chindad operations, where they decide, okay, we're not having much luck with these kind of full frontal attacks, so we're going to drop forces well behind enemy lines and disrupt lines of communication. But that's very different to what the Americans want, which is, you know, it's a little bit like the debate, frankly, Patrick, which we've already discussed, for getting into Northwest Europe as quickly as possible. I mean, the Americans are great believers, you know, if we think it can be done, let's do it. But logistically, Burma is a very, very different place to Northwest Europe. And in any case, the issue with Northwest Europe was the amphibious landing, and they were right to be cautious there. Now, they're also right to be cautious in Burma because it is effectively mountainous and jungle terrain, pretty much the whole of Burma, apart from the coastal plain. And actually, a lot of the efforts prior to 1944 were made in Arakan, because it was seen, Arakan being the sort of coastal peninsula, because it was seen as being terrain that certainly conventional Indian British forces would have most, you know, luck, frankly, crossing. But by 1944, I mean, it's interesting that the operation we're going to be talking about, which is really a Japanese invasion and the attempts to thwart that by the 50th Indian Parachute Brigade, really, that is not deliberately by the Japanese, but it is something that's going to be preventing what ultimately will be the major Indian thrust into Burma, which ultimately is successful. And that's Slim's operation, this fantastic operation in early 1945, that if we are going to move on a year next year, Patrick, we'll have to debate and discuss that between ourselves, because it is one of the great operations, the great offensive operations of the Second World War. Some say arguably the greatest British Indian operation of the Second World War. But what we're talking about today is the Japanese actually foiling these plans by launching a major invasion of their own, Operation Yugo. And what Operation Yugo, you asked about the Americans sort of guaranteeing the land route in supplies into China. Yugo is effectively going to make that impossible, because its intention is to reach Dimapur, which is a road and rail, important road and rail network in Assam. And if they get that far, they really scuppered any chance the Allies have of using that northern route. So it's a tremendously important operation. We know how it ends, but the question is, were they these, you know, these absolutely knife-edge moments where things could have gone very differently? And that's really the point of today's discussion, because I don't think, personally, and I don't know how much you know about the Burma campaign, Patrick, but I don't think the parachutists have been given anything like the credit they deserve. And we'll talk a little bit about why that was so, because there was a lot of controversy after the battle. But I suppose we probably need to set the scene by talking a little bit about who they were.
Yeah, well, let's get down to this actual story we're focusing on today. And this is the Battle of Sangshak. You've written about this in your forthcoming History of British Airborne Forces, Sky Warriors. That's coming out next month, right? And you can actually get in ahead of the game and put your order in already. Is that the case, Saul?
All great outlets, Patrick, as you know. And the great thing, you know, back in the day, publication day was really, you know, the first chance anyone had to get their physical hands on the book. But of course, what all publishers try to do now in a strategic sense is build up pre-orders. So pre-orders are tremendously important, and every sale is important, but a pre-order is a guaranteed sale. That if you buy it on Amazon, interestingly enough, they will give you a price and they say, price guarantee. If it drops between now and the actual publication, then they'll charge you less. They'll give you a refund. So, you know, people, if they're very keen to get the book on day one, that's what they do. They pre-order. And of course, you know, we as authors love pre-orders, but it gives you a chance to build up a little bit of momentum. And again, back in the old days, Patrick, when a review came out too early, you thought, well, you know, no one's going to go and buy my book because they can't physically get in the shop. Well, you can pre-order it now online. Very simple. So it's not a problem if your reviews come 2 or 3 weeks early and 2 or 3 weeks late. So we'll have to wait and see when my first reviews come. Fingers crossed they're positive.
I'm sure they'll be terrific, Saul, as always. Okay. So just before we talk about the battle, let's get some idea of the 50th Indian Parachute Brigade, who are at the heart of it. When was this unit created, and what experience did it have up to actually getting into this fight?
Well, and the first point to make about parachutists is that, you know, we're used to airborne forces playing an important role. We've spoken about the rather poor performance of Russian airborne in the Ukraine war, haven't we, Patrick? But it's important to remember that they didn't really exist, certainly not in the British Army, before 1940. If we had any kind of sense of airborne operations, it would really have been flying people in and dropping the troops on the ground, but not delivering them from the air by parachute and glider, which is the whole point of airborne operations. And you can do this silently, quietly, and in, you know, in large numbers behind enemy lines. So that was the idea. And I suppose the story of Indian airborne is tied inextricably to British airborne. And we have to go back to the 5th of June, 1940. It's a date, by the way, Patrick, that's often confused. A lot of people, you know, cite 18th of June. I know it's only a couple of weeks later, but, you know, us historians like to get these things accurately. And I've seen original documents in which Churchill himself is saying we need, and I quote, parachute troops on the scale equal to 5,000, so he reckoned 5,000 at least, as one way of taking the fight to Nazi Germany's Fortress Europe. Of course, this is post Dunkirk. Things are looking very black for the British. We've lost the French, or at least are about to lose the French as allies, and we're really up against it. And he creates not only commando forces, but also this parachute force, but it's very nascent in those days. And as you won't be surprised to hear, Patrick, you know an awful lot about the Royal Air Force, or have written an awful lot about the Royal Air Force. There was a lot of inter-service rivalry, which really slowed down the expansion of these parachute forces. So Churchill wanted 5,000. What he initially got was 500 parachutists. And it took an awful long time to build up those numbers. But eventually they did get built up, so that, well, towards the end of the war, you now have three airborne divisions, one of which was Indian, the 44th Airborne Division in India. So to go back to the story of the 50th Parachute Brigade, that was the first Indian Parachute Brigade, and it was created towards the end of 1941. So we're already a year later from when Churchill originally asked for the creation of these parachutists. And a year later, finally, the 50th Indian Parachute Brigade is raised in and around Delhi. And what is really significant about it is the type of troops that it contains. Now, just to go back to the Indian Mutiny for a second, post the Indian Mutiny, the great rebellion of Indian troops against their sort of colonial masters in 1857, the British had this policy that in any brigade anywhere in India, there would always be one European, effectively British battalion. And that's exactly what they tried initially in the 50th Indian Parachute Brigade. There was one European battalion, one British battalion that was known as the 151st. And then there were two Indian battalions. Well, one was Indian, the 152nd, and one Gurkha. I'm guessing I don't need to explain who the Gurkhas are to the listeners, but just in case I do, I suppose it's worth remembering that Gurkhas have been part of the British Army, well, the Indian Army, but anyways, officered by Brits since 1815, since actually the British defeated the Nepalese, because that's where the Gurkhas come from. These are hardy hillmen. And they thought, well, these guys are actually very ferocious fighters. We could do with co-opting them ourselves. You might ask, well, what's in it for the Gurkhas? Well, what's in it for the Gurkhas is they're mercenaries, effectively. And you still see it today. We still have Gurkha units in the British Army today. They're also in the Indian Army, too. And although they come from neither of those countries, they are prepared to serve in their armed forces for regular pay, decent service conditions, and in the case of the Gurkhas in the UK today, residency status. So it was in the Second World War that the Gurkhas were seen as very ferocious, capable fighters. And one single battalion, the 153rd, in the 50th Indian Parachute Brigade, was composed of Gurkhas. But the other battalion's very interesting, Patrick, the 152nd, from the mutiny onwards, and particularly from the 1870s onwards, the Indian Army tended to recruit on a class and caste basis. That means that a whole battalion would be Gurkhas, Punjabi Muslims, Sikhs, or they would divide up the companies into these separate classes. Why? To prevent any one group actually dominating the Indian Army, and therefore a possibility of another Indian mutiny.
So these are discrete units. Everyone is a Muslim, everyone is a Hindu or whatever. So they're not integrated, if you like. Is that the case?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you think about it, let's just say you've got a brigade in Abbottabad or one part of India and Pakistan as it is now, but India as it was pre-Second World War. And they decide, you know, okay, we're unhappy with the Brits. We're going to rise up. We maybe support Indian nationalism. You've got a battalion right next to them with a very different psychology and ethnic makeup. So you might have Gurkhas next to them. You might have Sikhs next to them. And they will act as a sort of, they will counteract the threat of rebellion, because the major concern of the British post the Indian Mutiny was another rising. And you see this in the, you know, the awful tragedy in Amritsar, the Amritsar massacre, you know, completely unjustifiable. But if you need to understand the kind of paranoia that there might be another rising to understand why Dyer did what he did that day.
Yeah, that's when General Dyer, that's just better explain, that's when General Dwyer, was it 1917, was it? 1917, the Emirates?
I think it was 1919, actually, just after the end of the First World War.
So he basically massacred, I can't remember the numbers now, but it's something that kind of seared itself into the Indian collective memory, and indeed was a major impetus for the nationalist campaign, wasn't it, for Indian independence from the British Empire. Before we We better get onto the story pretty soon. But just, I think listeners will be interested to know, what's the actual relationship between the sort of British officers, if you like, and the troops? How many Indians are actually officers? Is it a kind of completely white dominated setup?
It's very interesting what they do. They create this kind of two-tier system. So the senior officers, the battalion commanders and the company commanders, were invariably European or British mainly, but white. And then the more junior officers tended to be Indian, and the NCOs and the soldiers, of course, would be Indian too. I say Indian as a sort of catch-all, and I include the Gurkhas in that terminology, but they would be from the subcontinent. And this was a means, of course, of keeping overall control. But they had that system to a certain extent, Patrick, before the Indian Mutiny, and it didn't always work out that well, because if the bulk of the battalion goes against their officers, then, you know, you've only got a few officers and they're going to be vulnerable, which is exactly what happens and happened. And not only were they, but also their families in many instances killed. So there is this paranoia, this determination to mix up these units, which is why the 152nd Parachute Battalion is so unusual, because it's no class and no caste. In other words, anyone can be recruited and they're all mixed up together. And you might imagine, well, you know, it's a, odds and sods there. But actually, as you discover from the Battle of Sangshak, the 152nd is an incredibly redoubtable formation commanded by a guy called Paul Hopkinson, who obviously is British, but he, like Gurkha officers to this day, Patrick, as you will have seen in some of the campaigns recently, had an incredibly close relationship with his soldiers. And almost invariably, these senior European officers could speak the language. So they could speak Hindustani, Gurkhali, you know, whatever the specific languages tended to be, they had that capability. And they tended to have a very close relationship. So in the end, the senior officers, to answer the question, were British. But below that, you then had Indian officers, and then below that, Indian NCOs and ordinary soldiers.
Okie doke. Well, shall we fast forward to the actual battle here? So tell us what's happening this time. 80 years ago. The drama comes about really because the Japanese have decided to throw everything in a kind of rather Japanese way. That was their way of war fighting into one sort of bold venture to break the stalemate that they're facing now with the, you know, massive buildup in the Pacific, the stranglehold that the Americans have got on there, essentially a blockade they've imposed on Japan. So they decide to stake everything on this bold move. And that bold move is to actually try to invade India. Who's behind the plan and what did it hope to achieve?
Well, the commander involved is Renya Mutaguchi, and he's the new commander of the Japanese 15th Army, which is the army in Burma at that time. And he's heavily influenced in his thinking about the sort of strategic possibilities of invading India by a man called Subhas Chandra Bose. And Bose is the commander of the Indian National Army. Now, the Indian National Army has been recruited by the Japanese from former Indian soldiers who are disgruntled with their British masters and who have been sold a line that, you know, once we get back to India, we're going to kick the British out and you can then run your own country. In reality, of course, the Japanese would have effectively run India if that had succeeded like a puppet state. But nevertheless, Mutaguchi had been persuaded by Bose that not only will the guys who've already gone over to the Indian National Army going to help with in this enterprise, but they're going to recruit a lot of other Indian soldiers that they come across. And in fact, during the Battle of Sangchak, Patrick, there are many instances where these INI soldiers who are fighting with the Japanese, of course, are calling across to their comrades and saying, come and join us, leave the British, you know, we're going to free India, all this sort of stuff. It doesn't work. And one of the reasons it doesn't work is because, as you've already asked, this relatively close relationship between the Brits officers and their soldiers. They trust their officers and they don't want to go over to the Japanese. And they probably have a sense that, you know, being ruled by the Japanese is not going to be that much better if indeed you have a problem. Being ruled by the British. So it's not successful, but Mutaguchi has been convinced that it might be. So in a nutshell, Operation Yugo, which is the offensive into India, involves three divisions crossing the river Chindwin into the Assam province of India. The plan is to cut off and destroy the forward divisions who aren't expecting this attack, of course, of the Indian 4th Corps. That's commanded by a man called Lieutenant General Schoons. And once they've got through 4th Corps to Imphal and Kohima, these two absolutely key defensive bulwarks on the frontier of Assam. They're then going to head for Dimapur, as I mentioned before. So that's the plan. And standing in their way, more by luck than anything else, is the 50th Indian Parachute Brigade.
Righty-ho. So that's the plan. How did it develop? And what role did 50th Para Brigade play in it?
Well, the Mutaguchi's men crossed the Chinwin on the 8th of March, and Schoons is pretty slow to react. And one of his divisions is in serious danger of being cut off. But north of it, so you've got Imphal, and further to the north of Imphal is Kohima. And really guarding that junction between the two is the 50th Indian Parachute Brigade. It's been put into a blocking position close to a track junction called Sheldon's Corner. And it's interesting to think of the terrain here, Patrick. I mean, a brigade staff officer noted that it was breathtaking country, but progress anywhere was slow because of the narrow mule tracks and footpaths, vertical in places, which had to be followed much of the time. One false move by man or mule could result in a 1,000-foot plunge down the Kud side, down the mountainside. So by the 19th of March, as elements of the Japanese 31st Division are attacking and eventually overrunning an outpost of the 152nd Parachute Battalion near Sheldon's Corner, I mean, it's an amazing last stand. It's pretty much completely wiped out. You know, extraordinary heroics go on there. But while that's taking place, it gives enough time for the rest of the 50th Brigade. That's the rest of the 152nd, the 153rd Gurkhas, and all the supporting units you get in a brigade, medical, artillery, engineers. They can then withdraw into a defensive position, which is at Sangshak. And now they've been ordered, their brigadier, a guy called Tim Hope Thompson, has been ordered to form a strong box at Sangshak. Now, given I've just given you an idea of the description of the terrain, Patrick, you can imagine that this is on a hillside, basically. It's a flat bit of ground, about a half a mile long, described as a barren hilltop, some half a mile long by a quarter wide. And in that position, they construct a defensive redoubt. So this is Rorke's Drift in Assam, India, in 1944, effectively.
Sounds like amazing stuff. So they're basically set up there, manning the line, dependent, of course, for resupply on the RAF, aren't they, at this point? That's really the only way they're going to be able to keep fighting. But you've got this rather, you know, as always, a bit of an underestimate on what the Japanese are actually capable of doing. So tell us how many men are in there and what are the conditions?
Well, I mean, I've already described the area. Just imagine, so you've got 2,000 guys in there, including their artillery weapons. Generally speaking, by the way, the parachutists, I hope the listeners are aware, you know, they're intended as light shock troops. They never have that much in the way of heavy equipment in terms of machine guns or artillery. It's already always light kit, and they're not designed to fight long defensive battles. So this is absolutely not what they were intended for. You drop them behind enemy lines, they cause a lot of disruption, they capture a bridge or some strategic location. But to fight a defensive battle of this type is not what they've been trained for. And you could argue, of course, that the 50th Parachute Brigade is, you know, effectively its airborne capability is being thrown away. But nevertheless, as we're going to discover, they play an absolutely crucial role in Sangshak. So you've got about 2,000 men, including the two parachute battalions I've already mentioned. The 152nd, of course, is lost to company, so it's under strength now. But nevertheless, about 2,000 guys. They interestingly, they're not wearing helmets. They remove their distinctive red berets, the paratroopers, and they are wearing standard jungle green uniforms with a patch pocket on the front right leg. On their heads, they sported slouch hats, woolen caps, or in the case of the Gurkhas, broad-brimmed felt hats. Now, this is not going to be very useful to, you know, to ward off shrapnel injuries when the Japanese bring up their heavy artillery, which they do later on in the battle. The other issue, Patrick, as you've already pointed out, is they can only be resupplied from the air, particularly when the battle gets underway. And this is a very inefficient way of doing it, as we know from Arnhem, when, of course, a lot of the drops go into enemy lines. Exactly the same happens at Sangshak. And they get very little in the way of ammunition and food. So they pretty much got to survive on what they've got. And they are going to run out of ammunition and food relatively quickly, not surprisingly. And also the issue they've got is water. There is no water supply inside. You know, this is kind of a major problem, isn't it? Inside. So obviously they've carried as much water as they can in there, but resupply during the battle, they actually have to leave this position and try and get water, which of course is incredibly dangerous. And a lot of people lose their lives trying to do that.
What about in terms of weaponry? What have they got to repel the attack?
Yeah, so they do have some machine guns, Brens, and some light machine guns, and they do have some light artillery, as I've kind of indicated, kind of pack artillery. But for the average soldier fighting on the ground, I mean, he's got the kind of standard infantryman's kit, which are 303 Lee Enfield rifles. He'll have some grenades, but they're going to run out of those pretty quickly. Bayonets, of course, and the Gurkhas have their famous curved fighting knife, the Kukri. So, you know, they're going to be heavily outgunned when the Japanese bring up their heavy equipment, which makes the last stand, I suppose, in that sense, even more remarkable.
So here we are. They're in this defensive position at Sangchak. The situation is desperate. Tell us what happens next.
Well, the battle opens with a Japanese attack, which they hope will be a surprise attack at dusk on the 22nd of March, but it doesn't take anyone by surprise. The first assault is stopped in its tracks, mainly by the 152nd Battalion, which are defending that part of the western perimeter. And it costs one Japanese company, we know this from Japanese sources, 90 of its 120 men in 15 minutes of combat. But that's just the first attack, and the attacks continue throughout the night. And the Japanese are not only using psychological warfare with these INA guys calling out to their comrades, you know, surrender, you know, we'll treat you well, we'll kick the Brits out of India, but they're also using their kind of classic tactics of screaming and shouting as they come in for the attack. And it was a really disorientating experience for a lot of the Gurkhas and the Indian soldiers on the front line, very few of whom, Patrick, have actually seen combat before. So although they were highly trained and they'd gone through all their parachute training and they were supremely fit, and a lot of them were really good marksmen, they hadn't been in combat before. And so this was kind of real test of their nerves. Now, they fight off the initial Japanese attack, but the following morning, it's pretty clear that there are real weaknesses in the parachutist's position. So the slit trenches are too shallow, they're unprotected by barbed wire, and there are no communication or crawl trenches back to the rear. They're hemmed in by jungle, their forward posts have restricted fields of fire, and all ranks are at constant risk of being shot by snipers or machine gunners if they make the slightest movement in the open. So we've got this Rorke's Drift scenario in which they're surrounded by a far bigger Japanese force that is determined to break in and knock out this position. You might ask the question, Patrick, which would be a reasonable one. Why didn't the Japanese just bypass and leave a screening force? And they probably should have done, but so strategically sited was its location that any Japanese force moving in this direction and on to the two towns of Kohima and Imphal had to pass this location at some range, and therefore the Japanese were determined to knock it out. And the fighting continues, as we're going to discover, for the next 2 or 3 days.
Okay, well, it's nail-biting stuff, isn't it, Saul? We're going to take a break here. Join us afterwards to hear what happened when dawn came up on the 25th of March.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Want to get a chiseled look in the jawline? Sculpt and shape your jawline with added volume from Juvederm Volux XC. Juvederm Volux XC is an injectable gel specifically designed to be robust enough to improve moderate to severe loss of jawline definition. And it is the first and only hyaluronic acid filler approved for the jawline. Add volume to your jawline for a chiseled look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. Visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back. So here we are. The sun comes up on the 25th of March, and the scene is set for yet another assault by the Japanese on the position.
Yeah, I mean, this is really the moment of greatest danger, the 25th of March. And just to give a bit of context, the Japanese have brought forward their artillery on the 24th. So, you know, as I said before, if you, you know, this relatively small area, it's not going to take long for the Japanese to range in their guns. I mean, it's an absolute charnel house by this time. People are running out of water. They're wounded everywhere. They've got an aid post in the center of the location. But of course, you know, it's the wounded are getting wounded again. It's a really horrific experience. They're running out of water, ammunition, and food. And the Japanese have got their artillery, as I say. They have been given a rather encouraging note from their divisional commander, Uvri Roberts, who, you know, does rather well in this battle. And he sends a signal to them, well done indeed. This is on the 24th. You are meeting the main Japanese northern thrust. Of greatest importance, you hold your position. We'll give you maximum air support. Convey to all ranks my greatest appreciation of what you have already achieved. So you could argue, Patrick, that even by the 25th, they've sort of, you know, done most of what they've been expected to do. And frankly, they're just going to lose an awful lot more lives in holding on perhaps for another day. But they've been given this order by Uvri Roberts. And so they have, you know, no option but to stay there. And the following day, as you point out, dawn on the 25th of March is the point at which the perimeter almost collapses. The Japanese organize a three-company assault against the western position, which is held by the 152nd Paul Hopkinson's parachute battalion. And the weakness of that position is that there's a church in the northwest corner, which they've used as a kind of outer redoubt. But it's at this point that the Japanese actually managed to capture the church. By this point, most of Hopkinson's officers are either dead or wounded. And at 7:30 a.m. on the 25th, with the Japanese just 100 yards, so they've infiltrated through the church now, they've broken into the perimeter, and they're heading for brigade headquarters, which is right in the center of the defensive position. And obviously, if they get there, it's all over. That's the kind of nerve center of the defense of the battle. Hope Thompson is there, Tim Hope Thompson, the brigadier, and he orders his defense platoon, which is his, you know, the, as you know, Patrick, that offers defense for brigade headquarters. This is a last resort unit to counterattack the Japanese. And led by the young and intrepid Lieutenant Robin Delahaye, they managed to restore the situation temporarily. Delahaye and his men make a spirited attack, but they're cut to pieces by enemy fire from a hill out to the west. Now, in desperation, Paul Hopkinson, who's one of the only officers still standing in the 152nd Battalion, leads a counterattack himself with the odds and sods of his battalion HQ. So you've got the brigade defense platoon has been wiped out. Now it's these are the last gasp guys to try and defend the perimeter and particularly brigade HQ. These are runners, signalers, and orderlies. And amazingly, they managed to recover their lost positions. Hopkinson is badly wounded in this counterattack, and he's really out of the game from this point onwards. But the other key factor in the stabilization of the line, and I haven't mentioned them much, is that the Gurkhas also counterattack the Japanese at this point. And there's a lovely quote by a Japanese warrant officer after the battle. The Gurkha soldiers, he wrote, famous for their courage, rushed on and on, though many had fallen, screaming as they advanced despite their wounds. Hand-to-hand fighting was everywhere and hand grenades flew everywhere. Thus, the top of the hill turned to a hell on earth.
Wow, this is incredible stuff. So the fighting goes on all day.
Yeah, effectively. But this, you might be relieved, or the listeners will be relieved to hear, is the last day of fighting, because the casualties at this point, I mean, some of the battalions have been absolutely cut to pieces. The 152nd, there's not much left of it. The 153rd, the Gurkhas, they've lost about a third of their men. I mean, really, they're probably about a 50%, I would say, maybe less of the original soldiers are still capable of offering any resistance. And most of those guys were not the frontline parachuters. The vast majority of those are now dead. And so you can imagine the relief of Tim Hope Thompson, the brigadier, when he gets a signal. His perimeter is now much smaller than it has been. He gets a signal from the divisional commander, Uvri Roberts, at 6 p.m. Fight your way out. Go south, then west. Air and transport on the lookout for you. Good luck. Our thoughts are with you. So that night, he orders a mass breakout at 10:30 p.m. in a southeasterly direction to avoid Japanese positions, which they've identified are chiefly to the south.
Now, this is a very difficult operation, isn't it? Withdrawing under fire in any sort of good order is going to be very, very challenging. How do they get on?
Yeah, it is. I mean, some writers have described this as a kind of every man for himself situation. Actually, it wasn't. It was a bit more organized than that for obvious reasons, because they're having to take a lot of their wounded with them. They do leave the seriously wounded behind, and they're very conflicted about that, I have to say, Patrick, for the very good reason that they suspect the Japanese are going to murder everyone. They don't, amazingly. You can only conjecture that if it was the Germans, I'm not sure many of them would have been taken prisoner. But in any case, they do leave the worst wounded and they are looked after. I mean, I'm not, you know, they're not well treated, of course, because they, you know, once you get into a Japanese prisoner of war camp, it's going to be grim, but they aren't murdered out of hand, which is what they feared. So the guys on the run are in groups depending on their ability to move, basically. So the casualties are really going to be bringing up the rear, and the fittest are going to be at the front. And the idea is, let's try and get as many people away as possible. And incredibly, even though they're all moving at different speeds and they're in groups from 3 to 30, pretty much everyone who leaves the camp, not all of them, but pretty much everyone who leaves the camp does finally get back to safety. I mean, it's the most extraordinary withdrawal. Not only do they avoid contact with the Japanese, but they also have to climb three mountain ranges, some as high as 4,000 feet. So you go over one mountain, drop to the valley floor, and then you have to come back over the top of the next one. And you can imagine with a lot of casualties, everyone's exhausted because they've hardly slept for 4 days of fighting. One halt is so long that Major Harry Butchard, who's of the Gurkha Battalion, the 153rd, he moves up the column to find out what's going on, only to discover, in his words, that the men waiting to cross the ditch had fallen into a deep sleep. And the only way he can get the column moving again is by kicking them awake and saying, come on, we've got to move. So finally, after the initial withdrawal 2 days later, having narrowly avoided walking into an armed Japanese supply column, a lot of the guys had to roll into the thick elephant grass and just lie doggo while this Japanese supply column goes past them. The vanguard of the escapers stumble into a party of British officers and men brewing up a mess tin. They ask the officers what's going on, you know, what's the situation at Imphal. They don't really know what's happening to their rear, but it's clear now they've met the forward defensive position of Imphal. And finally, they reach the outskirts of Imphal itself on the 31st of March.
So what were the overall Indian Army casualties?
Well, I mean, as I was kind of suggesting, the worst casualties are taken during the battle. The 50th Brigade, really, given that it's at that stage of the war, is the only airborne formation east of Suez, is effectively destroyed. It's not going to go into battle anytime soon. They do rejuvenate it, and it does fight again in 1945, but that's a whole year later. It's going to take a whole year to retrain and refill its ranks. I talked about the 152nd Parachute Battalion. It had lost 90% of its original strength of 700, and most of those were killed, not casualties, dead. Only two officers and 90 men of those original 700 reached Imphal unscathed. The 153rd lost about a third of its men. A lot of the other units fighting in Imphal, similar sort of casualties. And yet, on the other hand, the brigade group, the 50th, is estimated to have taken a toll on the enemy of up to 2,000 dead. So in stopping the Japanese force, they didn't just hold it up, and time was absolutely crucial while the defenses were put into place in Kohima and Imphal. They actually exacted a real fearsome toll on the enemy in terms of dead and wounded.
Well, presumably they got those who made it out were welcomed as heroes after this incredible performance.
Well, you would have thought there'd be a lot of VCs handed round, wouldn't you? And a lot of credit given to the senior commanders, Tim Hope Thompson. Actually, shamefully, the opposite happened. Immediately, no sooner the 50th Brigade arrived, disheveled, with a lot of casualties at Imphal, then rumors began to, you know, spread across the rest of the 14th Army, but the 4th Corps in particular, that the brigade had done a runner, basically, had faltered and run away. And the brigade commander, Tim Hope Thompson, who had a concussion during the battle and kind of lost control for a brief moment, he was blamed by the commander of 4th Corps, Schoons, for misjudging the direction of the Japanese attack and mismanaging his response. He didn't mismanage his response, as you can see from my description of the battle. But Schoons, I think, was trying to cover up his own inadequacies. He had been very slow, as I said before, to react to the situation. And this was really a question of passing the buck. Now, Tim Hope Thompson, who could have explained exactly what had happened and why, wasn't in a position to do that because he's effectively demoted in rank and sent back to Britain in disgrace. And it's really interesting what happens to him later on in his career, because he was a brigade commander. He's busted back to lieutenant colonel, and he fights on in the Second World War in Northwest Europe in command of a battalion, and actually wins the DSO in 1945. And in some ways, this was his attempt to wipe out, you know, whatever question marks there were over his leadership. But it was completely unfair, Patrick. The officers of the 50th Brigade who had survived, and there were a few in the Gurkhas, were furious about this. One young officer that I used in my account of the battle in the book, Sky Warriors, wrote, "It was impossible to avoid the conclusion that the 50th Indian Parachute Brigade and its commander had been made scapegoats for the errors and omissions of those above them."
So when did it become clear that what had actually happened was that they'd fought a decisive encounter, which basically saved the British bacon at that point, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting about this situation is that you might think, oh, well, all of, you know, the 50th Brigade's role is covered up for a long time, and only later does it come out, only later do historians reveal it. Actually, to a certain extent, they were given credit. So there's this kind of mixed messaging going on. I mean, the divisional commander, I've already mentioned, Uvery Roberts, does write very soon after this, "The brigade with its attached units fighting under what must have developed into most appalling conditions," and he was certainly right there, "had undoubtedly saved Imphal and Kohima from the danger of being immediately overrun by the Japanese spearhead troops." So it is clear, you know, from Uvery's Roberts' words, that this was an absolutely crucial engagement. And I think the final and most important accolade given the 50th Brigade was after the war, when former members of the Japanese units that had fought at Sheldon's Corner and Sangshak against the parachuters go further by insisting that, and I quote, "the heavy casualties they suffered," that is the Japanese, "they suffered, and the 7-day delay completely disrupted their plans and worse still, throughout their timetable. If the 50th Parachute Brigade had cracked or been overrun in the first fierce onrush of the attack," write these former members of the Japanese units, "as they fully expected it would do, the whole of the Japanese 15th Division would have pulled straight down the last 36 miles of excellent road into the Imphal Plain, which at the time was denuded of our troops who had all gone south, annihilated 4th Corps, and seize the airfield." So it really was an absolutely crucial moment to hold on just for those extra few days so that the 4th Corps could get itself, you know, back into gear. Was Schoons ever held accountable, you know, for defaming effectively the 50th Brigade? No, he wasn't. He was given credit for, you know, what 4th Corps had done by Slim. And really, he was a great favorite of Slim's, unfortunately. And I think Slim protected him to a certain extent. But it's not a chapter, I think, that the 50th Indian Parachute Brigade has ever really been given the credit it deserves.
So this sets the scene really for the British fight back, doesn't it? In the battles of Imphal and Kohima, the Japanese are basically pushed back and the way lies open for the reconquest of Burma by Slim and the 14th Army. I think before we finish the story, we should say something about Slim, because listeners who take an interest in the British role, particularly in the war, will remember he's usually given the accolade of being the most able as well as the most well-liked of the British senior commanders in the field. But he had an unusual background, didn't he? So for a British army general at the time, that is, you know, he came from humble origins. He was a grammar school boy. I think he worked as a primary school teacher before the First World War intervened. He signed up for the Warwickshire Regiment, I think, and was given a commission, and that was the beginning of his military career. But he was unusual in that he was extremely able, but also rather kind of humble and self-effacing, unlike many of his contemporaries. Do you rate him as the best?
Very high. Yes, I rate him very highly. I mean, you're obviously referring to Monty, who's a completely different character. Monty was able, but Monty was limited, actually. You know, I'm writing about Tunisia at the moment. The final battle that Monty fights in North Africa is at Infidaville, which is effectively a defeat. I mean, they don't achieve what they set out to do. And it's often forgotten, you know, in the description of Monty having led the glorious Eighth Army from Alam Halfa, El Alamein, all the way through to Tunisia and the defeat of the Axis armies in Tunisia, which was highly significant, but it's often forgotten that this final battle was effectively a defeat. And of course, the first thing Monty tried to do is, you know, blame everyone else. Nothing to do with me. You know, this is Alexander, you know, for dissipating the attack. We should have just concentrated in one point. Slim completely the opposite. If you read Slim's memoirs, which are some of the finest memoirs written by a general in the Second World War, which I think are entitled Defeat to Victory, because, of course, the Indian Army is initially pushed out of Burma and then eventually gets all the way back to Rangoon with Slim in charge. And what Slim's got, he's a brilliant trainer of soldiers. You often find this with great commanders, Patrick. They realize you've got to get the guys ready for what lies ahead. Monty was also a very good trainer of men too, it's true. But what Slim was able to do is talk to them as if he was one of them. And the fact that he comes from a lower middle caste background probably helped him do that. He absolutely understood the, you know, these ordinary guys from these kind of pretty tough urban environments that a lot of them would have come from. He had much more in common with them than Monty did from his sort of background. But he also realized something else, that psychologically they had to believe they could defeat the Japanese. So that was partly training, it was partly the jungle experience, which was very useful in terms of the experience of the Chindits. And the Chindits, although, you know, it wasn't an unbroken run of success in their operations, but they did show that they could bloody the Japanese nose. And I think psychologically, this was of tremendous value. Slim put a great story in jungle training, in getting his guys used to the fighting in this really inhospitable and confusing and disorientating terrain. And all of this made a tremendous difference. But he also had a feel for battle, which is, you know, when to put in the right unit and when to move these big formations around. And as I've already alluded to earlier in this episode, Patrick, ultimately this is going to be shown to its greatest effect in his offensive operation at Mactila, which is a kind of brilliant use of deception and this wide hook attack, which succeeds brilliantly. And unlike a lot of Monty's operations, which do lead to victories, but Monty's always accused of never following up and destroying an army. And that's what Slim manages to do at Mactila. He destroys a large Japanese force, doesn't allow it to get away. So we'll possibly talk about that to come, but he was a remarkable commander. And in my view, we'll never know, Patrick, because he never fought against the Germans. We'll never know how he would have done. But against the Japanese, and they were pretty formidable, as we know, he achieved some remarkable results.
Okay, great stuff. Thank you very much for that, Saul. Okay, we're going to move on now to some of your questions. We've got a big batch of fascinating inquiries, but also lots of contributions, you know, pointing up stuff that certainly I didn't know. We're going to start off with one from David from Ontario, Canada. He says, in your Battleground 44 podcast, have you considered giving a few minutes to cover the USA 442 Regimental Combat Team? It's an interesting story as it was composed of Japanese Americans, many of whom volunteered while incarcerated in internment camps. This, of course, is the American policy at the start of the war to round up people of Japanese origin and put them behind barbed wire, essentially. So, you know, some of these guys in this regimental combat team, actually, their families were still being interned while they were fighting for the United States of America. But despite all this, they became the most decorated regiment in U.S. history, receiving 8 presidential unit citations, 21 medals of honor, 52 distinguished service crosses, etc., etc. And they began fighting in Europe in 1944 in Italy. And so David rightly says, I'm sure many listeners would not be aware of the 442nd and their distinguished history, but you know something about them, Saul, don't you?
I do, because I reviewed a book called Facing the Mountain, The Forgotten Heroes of the Second World War by an American author called Daniel James Brown. That was published in the UK by Viking, I think, Patrick, which is your publishers, 2 or 3 years ago. And I reviewed it for the Daily Telegraph, and I was absolutely astonished at a story I knew very little about. So obviously people can buy the book if they want to know about it in great detail. But I'm just going to give you a quick summary, because some of the statistics are, you know, off the charts. And you've already talked about the number of medals of honor, distinguished service crosses, etc., that they won. But just think about this. From the 1st of February 1943, Nisei men, that second generation Japanese Americans, were allowed to volunteer from the camps where they'd been segregated since the beginning of the war for a single American combat team, the 442nd. President Roosevelt made it official when he wrote to the Secretary of War, Americanism is not and never was a matter of race or ancestry. A good American is one who is loyal to his country and our creed of liberty and democracy. Every loyal American should be given the chance to serve his country. And so 14,000 Nisei men fought in the 442nd in Italy, France, and Germany from the summer of 1944 to the end of the war. So it's very pertinent to our 44 series, and we may even look at, dig into this in a little bit more detail. We've already talked about the number of medals of honor they won and the various awards. I mean, you know, astonishing 18,000 awards, including 4,000 Purple Hearts. That's for soldiers wounded in combat. But their finest hour, just to briefly mention, Patrick, was the rescue of the so-called Lost Battalion, a unit of the Texan National Guard that had been cut off behind enemy lines in France's Vosges Mountain in October 1944. When the survivors of two companies of the 442nd finally broke through, the Texans were astonished by their haggard appearance and diminutive stature. Even so, one admitted, they looked like giants to us. The Nisei soldiers' sacrifices were rewarded in December 1944 when the US government announced that the relocation camps would close, and henceforth, the vast majority of people of Japanese ancestry would be allowed to travel and live anywhere in the country. And therefore, thanks to the 442nd, this really shameful chapter in American history was closed. Okay, moving on to one from Rob. Do you know how Jewish and Black POWs and the resident allies were treated by the Germans? I know of the amazing story of Master Sergeant Roddy Edmonds, who responded, "We are all Jews," when asked to identify Jewish POWs. But do we know what would have been their fate if Edmonds hadn't been a hero? Rob goes on to say, by the way, I do understand that Jewish Red Army POWs were systematically murdered. I read that even while the Germans were systematically starving Red Army POWs to death, Jews and commissars were shot immediately once identified. And even when the Germans started using Soviet POWs as slave labor and feeding them a bit more so they could, you know, so they could get some labor out of them, they continued murdering Jewish prisoners of war. Do you know anything about that, Patrick?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's certainly true that there was a massive difference in the way that the Germans treated Soviet Red Army prisoners and Western prisoners. So basically, the laws of war didn't have any purchase at all when it came to the treatment of anyone captured on the Eastern Front. And as you rightly point out, Rob, anyone identified as a commissar was immediately shot. But I mean, one way or the other, once you were in German hands, you had your chance of survival were pretty low. So I think the one estimate is that in total, maybe more than 3 million Soviet prisoners of war were either executed or died of starvation or overwork. So when they weren't actually just killing you, they were basically starving and working you to death. But there was a very different attitude towards the Western prisoners of war, i.e. British, American, French, who fell into German hands. They were more or less treated in accordance with the 1929 Geneva Convention, and most of them came home alive, including, it has to be said, the Jewish prisoners. Now, this is it is a fascinating thing that you've highlighted here. There were quite a large number of Jews among those who were captured. I think 60,000 prisoners of war among all those captured were actually Jewish. Now, against all expectations, they were actually given the same treatment as everyone else. Why was this? It's a mystery, because the Germans clearly were capable of anything when it came to their treatment of the Jews. Yet they, even though they knew there were Jews among the ranks of the prisoners, they chose not to actually single them out. Now, there are a couple of explanations for this. One is that, of course, they're concerned about the treatment of their own prisoners who are in Allied prisoner of war camps. But I think the more likely explanation is that the Holocaust was actually a secret that the Germans very much didn't want to reveal. So I think by actually singling out the Jewish prisoners and carting them off to some unknown but easily guessable fate would have actually advertised the fact that this mass slaughter, systematic slaughter, was taking place. So, you know, they went to great attempts, the Germans, to hoodwink the West, to cover up what they were doing, you know, arranging. You know, Theresienstadt was one of the camps which they tried to make out was a kind of an example of how all Jewish internees, as they would put it, were being treated. And of course, it was a completely fake Potemkin village set up. And they invited, I think, the Danish Red Cross to visit it. And they came away saying, oh, yes, it looks fine. You know, so this undermined the building narrative in the West, and all the evidence that was flooding in, pointing to the fact that this great systematic industrialized murder was going on. So I think to have singled out the Jewish prisoners would have given the game away. And that's, to me, the most likely explanation for why, rather completely against all expectations, Jewish prisoners of war who were on the one of the Allied armies, by and large, managed to get through the experience unscathed. Now, Tim writes, I'm a big fan of the podcast. Outside of the occasional documentary, I haven't invested much time in learning about World War II history since I was at school, but I'm finding the episodes you're doing really fascinating and engaging. Now, he says, I was hoping I might be able to ask a question with regards to Korea during World War II. It's my understanding that at the end of World War II, Korea goes from being under Japanese control to being divided into spheres of influence until, quotes, Korea is ready to rule itself. Cold War tensions and internal rejection of the post-war status result in a failure to establish a unified Korean state. And before too long, the Korean War happens. Afterwards, the partition becomes permanent, resulting in the two Korean states we see today. He's basically saying, is this all, has he got it right?
Yeah, he has. But the detail's absolutely fascinating, Patrick. If you consider we're still living with the consequences of this, North Korea supplying Russia with arms and, you know, at daggers drawn with South Korea, it's worth reminding ourselves of the Second World War origins of the Korean War. And you have to go back to the last weeks of the war at the Potsdam Conference in July 1945. So the war in the West, of course, is over, but we've still got the war in the East. And it's at this point that US President Harry S. Truman gives Stalin a free hand to deal with Japanese troops in Korea and Manchuria. I mean, he's trying to get the Russians into the war to finish off the Japanese. They haven't decided to drop the bombs yet. Now, all of this changes after the dropping of the two bombs and Japan's unconditional surrender, because all of a sudden you've now got Russian troops in Korea where the Americans don't want them to be. So US troops are now available to take part in the occupation of Korea, and their presence is going to help the whole country from becoming communist, of course. So Truman's government suggests to the Soviets that they limit their advance to the 38th parallel, a line roughly halfway down the country. And this line, apparently, Patrick's chosen by two Pentagon officers on the grounds that it included more than half the population, the best agricultural land, and most of the light injury. And to Washington's amazement, the Soviets agreed. And so you then get the two, basically two different parts of Korea, North Korea, which is Soviet-sponsored, and the US-influenced South Korea. Now, after the last American troops leave in 1949, and the Soviets have already pulled out, you get increased tension between these two groups until North Korea finally decides to invade the South in 1950. North Korea, of course, by this point, a rigidly disciplined Stalinist government under the Russians' protege, Kim Il-sung. And in the South, of course, you've got the pro-American South, which is run by a pretty nasty character called Ryngman Sih, who's an authoritarian, but of course is pro-Western and he's not communism. And so you've now got the start of the war when North Korea invades the South. US responds, or at least the UN responds, by sending its own police force to kick the North Koreans out of the South. And that starts the Korean War. And where things get really rough in the end of 1950 is when it's looking like the American UN troops are going to get all the way to the Chinese border. And this is the point at which MacArthur's saying, well, MacArthur's being warned, don't go too close to the Chinese border because the Chinese might get involved in support of the North Koreans. And he says, if the Chinese getting involved, we'll bomb them to hell. I mean, you know, it's really inflammatory language, which ultimately leads to MacArthur being sacked. And what has been suggested will come to pass, it comes to pass at the so-called Battle of the Yalu River, which I've written about years ago, Patrick, in my military blunders book, you know, being MacArthur's blunder, not seeing all the obvious warning signs. And the Chinese then enter the war in huge numbers, and the fighting goes on for another couple of years until, lo and behold, they go back to the original line of demarcation, which is where they are today. So, but you can see how closely intertwined the fate of Korea was with the end of the Second World War.
Okay, well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for in terms of questions. There were some fascinating ones there that which we'd like to have dealt with. Maybe we'll return to them in a later episode, but thanks for sending them in. Keep doing so, please.
I should just mention that if anyone wants to find out more about the Battle of Sangchak in great detail, they should look up and buy David Allison's recent book, Fight Your Way Out, The Siege of Sangchak, India-Burma Border, 1944, and that was published last year. It's excellent.
So do join us again on Friday when we're bringing you up to date on all that's going on in Ukraine. Goodbye.
The first teller of my story is me.
This week on Disorder.
In this new world, When military power will be connected with high tech, small states can be very, very powerful.
Could small states help order the world?
Small states could be as effective, as dangerous as the big ones.
To find out, we're joined by Dr. Armen Sarkisian, Armenia's former president and prime minister.
In our two-part series, we discuss the history of the Armenian genocide,
the ongoing conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh,
and why small states could be the answer to the disorder in our world.
The big powers today have to compete in order to attract the small states to be their allies.
Search Disorder wherever you get your podcasts.